Broadcasting.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up today, we'll listen in on the hearings with William Barr, the Attorney General. He's being questioned right now in the Senate at the Senate Judiciary Committee. And we'll be hearing more about that just released letter by Robert Mueller, the special counsel. But first up today, new report shows that more than half of U.S. college students have experienced housing challenges. And almost half have experienced hunger. These findings are based on research conducted with 86,000 students. And we're going to talk with one of the co-authors of the report. She is Dr. Vanessa Coca. She is at Temple University's Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice. And Dr. Coca, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
It's really surprising to think that almost half of college students would have some problem with housing and food. Tell us what you found in your study.
Right. So the bottom line is that we find that basic needs insecurity is a condition challenging a large segment. You say it's half, right? So this is a large segment of students pursuing a post-secondary degree. And this matters because these conditions can serve as critical barriers to students' likelihood to attaining a degree.
So tell me about your research. Where did you look? Did you include any colleges or universities in Florida? And how long did this study take?
Right. So this study, we surveyed students in the fall of 2018. And we surveyed students, as you mentioned, 86,000 students across 123 colleges and universities in 24 states. Right. So there's we basically cover a large swath of the U.S. Population, and this is actually the fourth survey that we have done. And so what's interesting is that our findings are fairly consistent across the four studies in a number of ways that we cut the data.
Is there any reason to believe that a sizable number of college students these days around the U.S. are homeless?
Yeah, so, I mean, roughly the range of students who are homeless fall between maybe depending on the where the college and the or university is located, range between 14 and 20-something percent, which is a pretty surprising number to many education stakeholders. But, yes, we have good reason to believe that is the case.
14 to 20% of college students around the U.S. today might, at least sometime during the course of the school year, face homelessness.
Right, experience homelessness. And what's interesting about our study is we include couch surfing into that estimate. And so this is in contrast to the way the housing HUD essentially measures homelessness. And so we think couch surfing is particularly prevalent for college students. And so we take that into consideration when we think about homelessness.
Well, we're talking with Dr. Vanessa Coca. She's a co-author of a new report that says that about 1 in 2 college and university students in the U.S. face food and housing insecurity, and fewer getting the needed support. This study just came out. She's at Temple University's College of Education. So when you say food insecure, what does that mean?
Right. So this is basically not having consistent access to healthy and safe food. And we measure that for, we have students about in the last 30 days, whether or not they were concerned about having enough money to buy healthy foods, have a balanced diet. There are a number of questions that go into this measure of food insecurity. And so, yes, about 40-45% of college and university students report being food insecure.
What did you find about LGBTQ students and whether or not they face these kind of levels of housing insecurity and food insecurity?
That's an excellent question. We found that there are a number of student subgroups that are particularly vulnerable to food and housing insecurity, one being the one you mentioned, LGBTQ community. They're more likely to experience housing insecurity and homelessness than their counterparts, We also find that African American and Native American students are also more likely than their counterparts to experience food and housing insecurity.
And what about kids who have been in the foster care system?
Yes, students in the foster care system are much more likely than their counterparts to be homeless and experience housing insecurity overall.
Now, is there a difference between part-time students and full-time students?
Yes. So part-time students are more likely to experience housing insecurity than their full-time counterparts. We also found some differences by other student background characteristics, like whether or not the student is independent for financial aid purposes. Those students are also more likely to experience food and housing insecurity than students who are dependent.
And what about people who attend community college?
So, yes, overall, we find that students who attend two-year colleges are more likely to experience food and housing insecurity as well as homelessness than their counterparts in four-year institutions. And that's been pretty consistent finding across our annual surveys.
And one of the things that you found was that if a college student has children, they are more likely than the average to experience food or housing insecurity during the course of the year.
Right, that is true. Yes, so we see a higher rates. Students with children are more like 53% of them experience food insecurity, 66% experience housing insecurity. And so that number, particularly housing insecurity, is much larger than the rates for their peers who don't have children.
Our guest is Dr. Vanessa Coca. She's the co-author of a new report that's just come out that says that about half of U.S. college students are grappling with hunger and housing insecurity. She's a senior research associate at the Hope Center at Temple University in Philadelphia, and this is WMNF in Tampa. Vanessa, these numbers are astounding. I mean, for you to say a moment ago that 14 to 20% of college students here in the U.S. might experience homelessness at some point during their college career, I mean, that's just a pretty outrageous number.
Right. And when we talk about homelessness, and we often are pushed back upon, whether or not couch surfing should be it should count, and we often think it should. Some people think of couch surfing as just, staying, at your friend's house and sort of having a fairly positive experience. But we find that it's actually something that's much more problematic for students. It's also having the stress of not knowing where you're going to sleep, not knowing whether or not you can stay at your friend's house for the next week, the next month. Right. So, this is also problematic.
And it's got to impact whether or not the student ends up with a degree. If they're experiencing housing problems or food problems, at some point they might just want to give up and say the degree isn't worth it.
Absolutely. The research does find that students who experience housing insecurities in particular are more likely to see their grades drop. They're less likely to attend, high attendance rates, and ultimately they have a lower likelihood of completing their degree. So, yes, that is a concern.
So, Vanessa, what do you offer ideas about what can be done about this to solve the problem, or how do you expect the research to be used?
Right. I mean, we do offer recommendations in our report, but we think this is a larger systematic problem that will require solutions at multiple levels. But we do offer some recommendations at the college level. So, for example, we think that colleges can develop programs and practices that offer food and housing supports to low-income students. That could mean developing and expanding emergency aid programs. So these are cash assistance programs that are available to students who might face a small but a serious crisis where they might need some extra cash and don't have others to turn to. We find that could be a helpful resource. Also, we encourage colleges to engage community organizations and the private sector in developing and developing programs or partnerships that address the housing and food needs of the students they serve.
And what about public assistance? If you're a college student and you're whether you're going to a private college or whether you're going to a public college or a community college, are you eligible for things like SNAP, what we used to call food stamps? Are you eligible for housing assistance if your income is low, or do you have to just forego that?
Right. A lot of students are. There are some work requirements, particularly for SNAP, that can be somewhat complicated for students who are attending college. And so definitely encourage state policymakers and federal policymakers to consider those work requirements for college students and what that means for whether or not they have access to SNAP benefits. But also, there's just a general, students don't often know about all of these requirements and don't know about all the benefits that they are eligible to receive. And so one other recommendation that we can give is to have a place at the post-secondary institution, maybe an office, a hub in some ways that can direct support to students and inform students of the benefits that they are eligible to take on.
Vanessa, I've got a friend who works at one of those crisis lines, or she used to work there, and the crisis line was for any college students who were in trouble, and she used to get a lot of calls from local colleges and universities from students who either had no connection with their family, their parents, or they were on their own. They many times were living in their cars, and they were still trying to go to college, trying to get a better education so that they could get a good job, so that they could make a lot of money and get out of their poverty. I'm wondering if you've heard just anecdotally in doing the study whether or not there are many college students around the country living out of their car and yet going to class every day.
Absolutely. That is definitely part of the homelessness experience for college students. We hear about a lot of students living out of their cars. And what's interesting is just in general, students who are facing these basic needs insecurities is they are making economically rational decisions on their part, right? They see that a college education leads to a pathway to the middle class, essentially. And so they're trying their very best to make that choice and get that college degree. However, they're finding that these barriers are basic needs, food and housing, are really causing barriers to whether or not they can actually meet their goals of getting that college degree. And so from a larger perspective, from a policy, from a city, from a state, from a federal policy, we need to make sure that when we invest in these students, that students are able to achieve those goals.
Vanessa, one last question. Let's say that there were congressional hearings about poverty among college students around the country, and that you were in charge of getting the witnesses to come to these congressional hearings. Would it be hard for you to find people that go hungry every day or are homeless frequently? Would it be hard for you to find enough people to go to Congress to say this is an actual problem here in the U.S.?
It would not be a problem at all. It would be fairly easy. These students look like your everyday students. They just don't often share them publicly that they're experiencing these needs. But these students, our study backs up that these students are a large segment of students on campuses.
Well, Dr. Vanessa Coca, thanks a lot. Where can people see the study?
Yes. Well, you can access our study at our website. It's Hope for College. That's HOPE4 college.com. That would be the easiest way to access it.
And Dr. Koch, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, this is definitely a critical time. These issues are bringing to light some of these larger issues of economic inequality, and I hope that the stakeholders that are serious about moving the needle on college completion rates really pay more attention to the real experiences of college students today.
Dr. Coca, thank you for coming on MNF.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Great to have you here. That's Dr. Vanessa Coca. She's the co-author of this new report that finds that more than half of college and university students faced housing insecurity in the past year, and 45% of students across the country were food insecure. Dr. Coca is a senior research associate at the Hope Center. That's Temple University's Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice. And you're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF in Tampa. We're going to go up to Washington, D.C. right now. As you know, there are new calls for the Attorney General of the U.S. to step down or be removed from office. And I'll just read one story. In Washington, a Democratic senator says Attorney General William Barr should resign. Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen says that the Attorney General lied to him at a hearing last month in testimony about Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report. In that hearing, Barr replied to Van Hollen that he didn't know if Mueller agreed with his conclusions about the report, including that there wasn't enough evidence in the report to support a charge of obstruction of justice. Mueller had left that question open in the report, which had not yet been publicly released, but it was revealed late yesterday that Mueller had indeed expressed frustration to Barr about how his findings were portrayed before Barr was questioned by Van Hollen last month. And Van Hollen says that Barr totally misled me, the Congress, and the public. He must resign. And a letter from Robert Mueller to Attorney General Barr, which was written March 27th of this year. I'll just read one paragraph from it. As we stated in our meeting of March 5th and reiterated to the Department of Justice early in the afternoon of March 24th, the introductions and executive summaries of our two-volume report accurately summarize this office's working conclusions. The summary letter the Justice Department sent to Congress and released to the public late in the afternoon of March 24th did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of this office's working conclusions. We communicated that concern to the department on the morning of March 25th. There is now public confusion about critical aspects of the results of our investigation. This threatens to undermine a central purpose for which the department appointed the special counsel, to assure full public confidence in the outcome of the investigations. That's part of the Robert Mueller letter that's just been released today. Let's go to Washington, D.C., where Attorney General William Barr, who received that letter from Mueller in March, is testifying now before the Senate Judiciary Committee. This is WMNF in Tampa, and one of the Republicans is asking Mr. Barr a question.
Well, you could have different kinds of defensive briefings. If you learn that somebody is being targeted by a hostile intelligence service, then one form of defensive briefing is to go and to alert that person to the risks.
I think Attorney General Lynch has said it is routine in counterintelligence investigations. Would you agree with her?
Yes.
Do you know whether a defensive briefing was ever given to the Trump campaign by the FBI based on their counterintelligence investigation? Did they ever tell the president before he was January 2017 what the Russians were trying to do and advise him to tell people affiliated with this campaign to be on their guard and be vigilant about Russian efforts to undermine public confidence in the election?
My understanding is that didn't happen.
That would be an that failure to provide a defensive briefing to the Trump campaign, that would be an extraordinary or notable failure. Would you agree?
I think under these circumstances, it's one of the things that I can't fathom why it did not happen. If you're concerned about interference in the election and you have, you know, substantial people involved in the campaign who were former U.S. attorneys. You had three former U.S. attorneys there in the campaign. I don't understand why the Bureau would not have gone and given a defensive briefing.
Thank you.
Senator Durbin.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, General Barr.
Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois.
Republican colleagues on the other side, and it appears that they are going to work together and coordinate the so-called locker-up defense. This is really not supposed to be about the Mueller investigation, the Russian involvement in the election, the Trump campaign, and so forth. It is really about Hillary Clinton's emails. Finally, we get down to the bottom line. Hillary Clinton's emails and questions have to be asked about Benghazi along the way. What about Travelgate, Whitewater? there's a lot of material we should be going through today, according to their response to this, that is totally unresponsive to the reality of what the American people want to know. They paid a lot of money, $25 million for this report. I respect Mr. Mueller and believe he came up with a sound report, though I don't agree with all of it. But I find, General Barr, that some of the things that you've engaged in really leave me wondering what you believe your role as Attorney General is when it comes to something like this. Listen to what, since it's put in the record, let me read it. Listen to what you received in a letter on March 27th from Bob Mueller. The summary letter the department sent to Congress and released to public late in the afternoon of March 24th did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of the office's work and conclusions. We communicated that concern to the department on the morning of March 25th. There is now public confusion about critical aspects of the results of our investigation. This threatens to undermine a central purpose for which the department appointed the special counsel, to assure full public confidence in the outcome of the investigations. I cannot imagine that you received that letter on March 24th and could not answer Congressman Crist directly when he asked you whether there were concerns about representations being made on these findings by the people working for Bob Mueller. You said, no, I don't know, after you received this letter. What am I missing?
Well, as I explained to Senator Leahy, I talked directly to Bob, and Bob told me that he did not have objections to the accuracy.
Attorneys don't put things in writing unless they're pretty serious about them. Well, there's an old rule in politics. A good politician doesn't write a letter and doesn't throw one away.
Okay.
So I got to ask you, if he puts it in writing of his concerns or your representations on March 24th, you couldn't recall that when Congressman Crist asked you that question a few days later?
No, I'm saying that this was the March 24th letter stated that Bob Mueller did not reach a conclusion on obstruction. And it had the language in there about not exonerating the president. My view of events was that there was a lot of criticism of the special counsel for the ensuing few days. And on Thursday, I got this letter. And when I talked to the special counsel about the letter, my understanding was his concern was not the accuracy of the statement of the findings in my letter, but that he wanted more out there to provide additional context to explain his reasoning on why he didn't reach a decision on obstruction.
I'll just say this, Mr. Barr. If you received a letter from Bob Mueller a few days after your March 24th letter, it was clear he had some genuine...
All right, we're having a little bit of trouble with the playback from the hearings. This is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM, and we're going to try to reconnect with the hearings that are going on in Washington, D.C., at the Senate Judiciary Committee. Right now, William Barr, the Attorney General, is being questioned by Dick Durbin, who is a senator, Democratic senator from Illinois. Let's see if we can pick up again the hearings.
Capture everything. My answer to that is I'm not trying to capture everything. I'm just trying to state the verdict.
No, you just absolutely used the word summarize, though, in your letter.
Summarize the principal conclusions.
Principal conclusions, which most people would view as a summary. But let me move to another topic, if I can, for a minute. The Office of Legal Counsel's decision as to whether or not you can prosecute a sitting president, you had some pretty strong feelings of that, and they were reflected in your volunteered memo to the Trump defense team, your 19-page memo.
Did I discuss that?
You certainly discussed whether or not a president should cooperate with an investigation. You said at one point in summarizing the findings of Mueller that the White House fully cooperated. We know for a fact, and you've stated already, the president never submitted himself to what was characterized as a vital interview, an actual sit-down interview under oath, not once, and that his questions that were answered some 30 times, his memory failed him. So to say the White House fully cooperated, that I think is a generous conclusion. On this Office of Legal Counsel, I would refer you to this volume 2 of the Mueller report. And on page 1, he talks about the whole issue of whether or not he was in any way restricted in what he could conclude because of the outstanding Office of Legal Counsel opinion on the liability of a sitting president. You dismissed that in your opening statement and said we asked him two or three times. He said that that had nothing to do with it. Well, how do you explain on the first page of Volume 2 that he says it had a lot to do with it? It's a reason he couldn't reach a binary conclusion on obstruction of justice.
No, it was a prudential reason, one of the backdrop factors that he cited as influencing his prudential judgment that he should not reach a decision, which is different than citing the OLC, saying that but for the OLC opinion, I would indict.
I'm just going to stand by what he has written, and I ask others to read it as well. The last point I want to make is about Don McGahn. If you read the section here, pages 113 to 120, on Don McGahn's experience, the president wanted him to state publicly that the New York Times article was untrue, that he had not asked McGahn to fire the special counsel. McGahn refused, and there's some speculation as to whether he risked being dismissed or even resigning over this issue. And for you to suggest that this was some sort of a kabuki dance with Rob Rosenstein, I think the president's intent here was very clear. He wanted this to end. He told Lester Holt, going back to the issue that was raised by the chairman earlier here, the reason to get rid of Comey is because of the Russian investigation. I mean, over and over again, this president was very explicit, and it certainly is very expository in his style. So I don't understand. Let me ask you this in conclusion. My time is up. Do you have any objections? Can you think of an objection of why Don McGahn shouldn't come and testify before this committee about his experience?
Yes, I mean, I think that he's a close advisor to the president.
Never exerted executive privilege.
Excuse me?
He may have already waived his...
No, we haven't waived executive privilege.
Well, at this point, do you believe... You're saying, Don... What about Bob Mueller? Should he be allowed to testify before this...
I've already said publicly, I have no objection to him.
And Don McGahn, should he be allowed to testify?
That's a call for the president to make.
Well, he's a private citizen at this point, as I understand.
Well, I assume he'd be testifying about privileged matters.
Well, I would hope that we could get to the bottom of this with actual testimony of witnesses after we've taken another close look to Hillary Clinton's emails. Thank you.
We might do that. Senator Lee.
In his classic dissent in Morrison v. Olson, Justice Scalia remarked that nothing is so politically effective as the ability to charge that one's opponent and his associates are not merely wrong-headed, naive, and ineffective, but in all probability, crooks. And nothing so effectively gives an appearance of validity to such charges as a Justice Department investigation. That observation has, I think, been borne out time and time again over the past 2 years. Time and time again, the president's political adversaries have exploited the Mueller probe, its mere existence, to spread baseless innuendo in an effort to undermine the legitimacy of the 2016 election and the effectiveness of this administration. For example, on January 25th, 2019, Speaker Nancy Pelosi asked, "What does Putin have on the president politically, personally, or financially?" Mr. Attorney General, is there any evidence to suggest that Vladimir Putin, quote unquote, has something on President Trump?
None that I'm aware of.
On February 20th, 2019, former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe said on national television to the entire nation that he thinks it's possible that Donald Trump is a Russian agent. Mr. Attorney General, is there any evidence that you're aware of that suggests even remotely that President Trump is a Russian agent?
None that I'm aware of.
Representative Eric Swalwell has repeatedly claimed that Donald Trump, quote, acts on Russia's behalf. Attorney General Barr, is there anything you're aware of to back that up by way of evidence? That the president acts on Russia's behalf?
None that I'm aware of.
So basically we've heard over and over again on national TV, in committee hearings on the House and Senate floor, and in the media, and we've heard about the president's alleged collusion with Russia. But what we have heard is as baseless as any conspiracy theory that we've seen in politics, any that I can think of. The only difference here is that the purveyors of this conspiracy were, in many cases, prominent members of the opposition party. That's concerning. Now, from the beginning, there were some indications that the Russia investigation was perhaps not always conducted with the absolute impartiality that the American people should expect and have come to hope to find in existence within the Department of Justice, especially given that the track record of excellence that the U.S. Department of Justice has shown. According to the Mueller report itself, the investigation into the Trump campaign began on July 31st, 2016, after a foreign government contacted the FBI about comments made by George Papadopoulos. Is that accurate, or were there other precipitating events that helped lead to this?
That is the account that has been given in the past as to how it got going.
You've previously said that you think it's possible that the Federal Bureau of Investigation improperly spied on the Trump campaign. I assume that's a reference to the FISA warrant for Carter Page. Is that what you have in mind, or are there other circumstances that you've got in mind there?
Well, one of the things I want to look, there are people, many people seem to assume that the only intelligence collection that occurred was a single confidential informant and a FISA warrant. I'd like to find out whether that is in fact true. It strikes me as a fairly anemic effort if that was the counterintelligence effort designed to stop the threat as it's being represented.
Was Carter Page under surveillance during his time working for the Trump campaign, which was roughly January 2016 to September 2016?
I don't know.
Was any other Trump campaign official under surveillance during that time period, to your knowledge?
Well, these are the things that I need to look at. And I have to say that, as I've said before, you know, the extent that there was any overreach, I believe it was a few people in the upper echelons of the Bureau and perhaps the Department. But those people are no longer there, and I'm working closely with Chris Wray, who I think has done a superb job at the Bureau, and we're working together on trying to reconstruct exactly what went down. One thing people should know is that the Bureau itself has been a little bit handicapped in looking back because of the pending Mueller investigation and the OIG investigation.
As we know, the FISA warrant for Carter Page was based largely on the so-called Steele dossier, and in particular on two specific facts about Page's trip to Moscow to deliver a speech in July 2016. First, according to the warrant, Page had a secret meeting with Igor Sechin, the president of Rosneft. Does the Mueller report confirm that Page met with Sechin?
Met with who?
With Mr. Sechin, with Igor Sechin.
Yeah, I can't recall, but I don't remember that. Let me just say that I want to stay away from getting too deeply into the FISA issue because that's currently under investigation by the OIG.
Understood. Second, and more importantly, the warrant also says that Page met with Igor Divyekin in order to discuss what is referred to as compromat involving Hillary Clinton, against Hillary Clinton. Does the Mueller report confirm that Page met with Divyekin?
I don't think so.
Does it confirm that Page discussed compromat on Hillary Clinton with anyone?
Not that I recall.
So since the main evidentiary support for the warrant has been discussed by the Mueller report, which is sort of the gold standard of what we're discussing here, I'm glad that you're looking into it. I'd encourage you to look into why the FBI relied on this false information. And I hope you'll share the results. The public obviously has a right to know what happened here. The U.S. Department of Justice and the Federal Bureau of Investigation have a long history and a long history of success that has been based on respect. They deserve to understand that there's not so much power that's been concentrated in that one agency, that the outcome of an investigation can depend on the whims of who might be assigned to it. They have a right not to believe that a particular investigation might be struck and paged, might not be tarmacked, might not be influenced by an improper consideration, politically or otherwise. Thank you, Mr. Attorney General.
It was Republican Senator Mike Lee. Mike Lee of Utah.
We'll do Senator Whitehouse, and why don't we just come back an hour later. We'll break for an hour and do the votes and have lunch. Senator Whitehouse.
Thank you, Chairman. Attorney General, you
this is Sheldon Whitehouse, a Democrat from Rhode Island,
which you described the importance of, to use Chairman Graham's words, hardening our electoral infrastructure against foreign election interference. I ask you, is anonymous election funding an avenue for possible foreign election influence and interference?
Yes.
Let's turn to the March 27th letter, which you received and read March 28th, the Mueller letter?
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
Yes.
When did you have the conversation with Bob Mueller about that letter that you've referenced?
I think it was on the 28th.
Same day that you read it? When did you first learn of the New York Times and Washington Post stories that would make the existence of this letter public, the ones that came out last night?
I think it could have been yesterday, but I'm not sure.
When they contacted you to ask for any comment?
They didn't contact me.
Contacted DOJ to ask for any comment?
I can't actually remember how it came up, but someone mentioned it.
So you, at some point you knew that the Mueller letter was going to become public, and that was probably yesterday?
I think so.
Okay. When did you decide to make that letter available to us in Congress?
This morning.
Would you concede that you had an opportunity to make this letter public on April 4th when Representative Crist asked you a very related question?
I don't know what you mean by related question. It seems to me it'd be a very different question.
I can't even follow that down the road. That's a masterful hair splitting. The letter references enclosed documents and enclosed materials, right? Are those the same things as what you called the executive summaries that Mueller provided you?
With this letter?
Yes.
Yes.
It's all the same document.
I'm sorry.
When you talk about the executive summaries that Mueller provided you, they are the documents that were the enclosed documents with that letter, which we have not been provided.
I think they were.
They
have been provided them. They're in the report. They're the summaries in the report.
It's the language of the report in the report? There's nothing else that he provided you then?
I think that's what he provided.
Okay. If there is anything else, will you provide it to us if it's different in any form? It's odd to be given a letter without the attachments to it when the attachments are referenced.
I think they were
the
redacted versions of the executive summaries that are embedded in the report.
Can we get that just to be sure?
Sure.
Great. Thank you. You agree that none of that material was either grand jury 6E or presented a risk to intelligence sources and methods or would interfere or compromise ongoing investigation were affected by executive privilege?
There were redactions made in the executive summaries. But as I said, I wasn't interested in putting out summaries, period.
Well, you know,
frankly,
this is another hair-splitting exercise because Bob Mueller, who I think we all agree is fairly credible, actually described your letter as a summary. So you can say it wasn't a summary, but Mueller said it was a summary. And I don't think...
I wasn't interested in summarizing the whole report. As I say, I was stating the bottom-line conclusions of the report.
Your letter says that it's intended to describe... I quote your words.
Yeah, describe the report, meaning volume one dealt
with this. When you describe the report in four pages and it's a 400-page report, I don't know why you're cavilling about whether it's a summary.
Because I state in the letter that I'm stating the principal conclusions. Let me also say that, you know, Bob Mueller is the equivalent of a U.S. attorney. He was exercising the powers of the attorney general subject to the supervision of the attorney general. He's part of the Department of Justice. His work concluded when he sent his report to the Attorney General. At that point, it was my baby, and I was making a decision as to whether or not to make it public. And I effectively overrode the regulations, used discretion to lean as far forward as I could to make that public. And it was my decision how and when to make it public, not Bob Mueller's.
With respect to the OLC opinion that informed Bob Mueller's decision, as he describes in the report, do you agree that that is merely an executive opinion and that under our Constitution, the decision as to what the law is made by the judicial branch of the United States government?
I'm sorry, could you...
With respect to the OLC opinion that informed Mueller's decision not to make a recommendation on obstruction, as he said in his report... Do you concede that that is an executive opinion and that under our constitutional system, what the law is gets decided by the judicial branch of government?
Yes.
Is there any way for the OLC's opinion to be tested by the judicial branch of government to see if it's correct or not?
None that comes to mind.
And it could be wrong, could it not?
I guess hypothetically it could be wrong.
And certainly there are respected legal minds that disagree with it, correct?
Excuse me?
There are many respected legal commentators and professors and lawyers who disagree with it, correct?
It's very hard to find lawyers that agree to on anything.
So the interesting thing to me is that it goes on to say that because of the OLC opinion, we have to give the president an extra benefit of the doubt because he is denied his day in court where he could exonerate himself. That seems like a fallacy to me. Because if you are the president of the United States, you can either waive or readily override the OLC opinion and say, I'm ready to go to trial. I want to exonerate myself. Let's go. Could you not?
How is this relevant to my decisions?
It's relevant
because I assumed that there was no OLC opinion.
Well, we have a report in front of us that says that this influenced the outcome. And in particular, it says it influenced the outcome because it deprived the president of his ability to have his day in court. And my point to you is that the president could easily have his day in court by simply waiving or overriding this OLC opinion that has no judicial basis. Correct?
Well, I don't think that there was anything to have a day in court on. I think that the government did not have a prosecutable case.
But Well, Mueller obviously didn't agree because he left that up to you. He said that he could neither confirm nor deny that there was a prosecutable case here. He left that to you. And when he did, he said, and you apparently have agreed, that this OLC opinion bears on it and that it would be unfair to the president to put him to the burden of being indicted and not having the ability to be charged.
I don't want to characterize have Bob's thought process on this.
I'm not asking you to characterize it. It's in his report. He's put it in writing.
I'm not sure what he means by that in the report.
With respect to the word, can I have a minute? I just want to nail down, you used the word spying about authorized DOJ investigative activities.
Are you talking about my testimony before the House Appropriations?
Yes.
Okay.
In the entirety of your previous career in the Department of Justice, including as Attorney General, have you ever referred to authorized department investigative activities officially or publicly as spying? I'm not asking for private conversation.
No, I'm not going to abjure the use of the word spying. I think, my first job was in CIA, and I don't think the word spying has any pejorative connotation at all.
The question
is always whether or not it's authorized and adequately predicated spying. I think spying is a good English word that, in fact, doesn't have synonyms because it is the broadest word incorporating really all forms of covert intelligence collection. So I'm not going to back off the word spying, except I will say I'm not suggesting any pejorative, and I use it frequently, as do media.
When did you decide to use it? Was it off the cuff in the hearing that day, or did you go into that hearing intending to use the word spying?
It was actually off the cuff, to tell you the truth, and the congressman, well, from Schatz, from Hawaii.
Who was here?
Shaheen?
No.
Whoever it was, go ahead.
Yeah, when he challenged me and said, you want to change your language, I was actually thinking, like, what's the issue? I don't consider it a pejorative. But if And frankly, we went back and looked at press usage, and up until all the FOIA outrage a couple of weeks ago, it's commonly used in the press to refer to authorized activities, such as referring to the FISA court as the spy court.
But it's not commonly used by the department.
What?
It is not commonly used by the department. My time is
commonly used by me.
Thank you very much. We'll come back at 10 to 1. Thank you.
Well, that was the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing testimony today from Attorney General William Barr. And big questions have been raised about whether or not the last time Barr made a series of appearances before members of Congress, whether or not he was telling the truth about the contents of the Mueller report. And we heard there Sheldon Whitehouse, the Democrat, asking those last questions. We're going to go back and listen to something that a local congressman said, asked Mueller in early April, and I want to get your take on this. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. We're going to listen back to actually two members of Congress. They had questioned William Barr earlier, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, rather, about the Mueller report. And this has raised quite a brouhaha in Washington. And I'll just read again what I mentioned at the top of going into these hearings. Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland says Attorney General William Barr should resign. Van Hollen from Maryland says that Barr lied to him at a hearing last month in testimony about Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report. During that hearing, Barr replied to Van Hollen that he didn't know if Mueller agreed with his conclusions about the report, including that there wasn't enough evidence in the report to support a charge of obstruction of justice. It was revealed late yesterday that Mueller had indeed expressed frustration to Attorney General Barr about how his findings were being portrayed before Barr was questioned by Van Hollen a few weeks ago. Van Hollen said, "Barr totally misled me, the Congress, and the public. He must resign." Now, both Van Hollen and St. Petersburg Democratic Congressman Charlie Crist questioned Barr last month, as did many other members of Congress. We're going to hear a bit of that testimony, starting with we're going to hear Charlie Crist and what he asked William Barr last month about whether or not Robert Mueller disagreed with the four-page summary of the Mueller report that Barr had written. Let's listen in on Charlie Crist, and then we'll listen in on Chris Van Hollen asking Barr questions a month ago. This is WMNF.
Reports have emerged recently, General, that members of the special counsel's team are frustrated at some level with the limited information included in your March 24th letter, that it does not adequately or accurately necessarily portray the report's findings. Do you know what they're referencing with that?
No, I don't. I suspect that they probably wanted, you know, more put out.
Charlie,
did Bob Mueller support your conclusion?
I don't know whether Bob Mueller supported my conclusion.
Now, that was Attorney General William Barr a month ago. Barr had in his hands this letter from Robert Mueller, the special counsel, and I'll just read one paragraph, and you tell me whether or not Attorney General Barr was being truthful a month ago. Mueller wrote this on March 27th. He said, "As we stated in our meeting of March 5th and reiterated to the department early in the afternoon of March 24th, the introductions and executive summaries of our two-volume report accurately summarize this office's working conclusions. The summary letter, though, the Justice Department sent to Congress and released to the public late in the afternoon of March 24th, did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of this office's working conclusions. We communicated that concern to the department on the morning of March 25th. Mueller went on to write, "There is now public confusion about critical aspects of the results of our investigation. This threatens to undermine a central purpose for which the department appointed the special counsel, to assure full public confidence in the outcome of the investigations." So Mueller there saying that the summary that Barr put out did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of the special counsel's work and conclusions. And he said that on March 27th in a letter to Attorney General Barr. Now, Barr was asked about that about a week later. Let's listen back to Charlie Crist questioning him, and then listen back to Chris Van Hollen questioning Attorney General Barr about whether or not Mueller had problems with the summary. Let's see if we can pick this up here. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. We're going to try to pick up Charlie Crist right now. All right, we are going to get this. I'm going to just bring it up in just a second. Here's a Charlie Crist asking the Attorney General a month ago whether or not Robert Mueller had problems with the summary.
General, that members of the special counsel's team are frustrated at some level with the limited information included in your March 24th letter, that it does not adequately or accurately necessarily portray the report's findings. Do you know what they're referencing with that?
No, I don't. I suspect that they probably wanted, you know, more put out.
Did Bob Mueller support your conclusion?
I don't know whether Bob Mueller supported my conclusion.
Did Barr tell the truth to those two members of Congress? What do you think? Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. And what do you think? 813-239-9663. We got some emails in. Here's an email from 813. They say, why is it when I see Lindsey Graham, there's a mini Limbaugh and Hannity whispering in each of his ears? That's a Greg in Carrollwood. Greg, thank you for that. Thanks to Don in Tampa for making a large donation to WMNF this hour. Thank you, Donna, for making that huge contribution to MNF. Thank you. Let's see. And Adam writes this. Adam says that this is absolutely wild. Barr is acting like Trump's defense attorney and is extremely combative, refusing to answer certain questions. Are you kidding me? Writes Adam. And then the 352 area code, Jeff in Newport Richey writes, Mueller was frustrated by the way the media described at the report. Why isn't the media in front of the committee being questioned? Why isn't the media being told that they need to resign, writes Jeff. Jeff goes on to say, Mueller should just stand there and say, I don't remember, I failed to recall, and I have no recollection. Democrats seem to love those answers. That's Jeff's opinion out there. And let's go to the phones for a second. Let's go to Cynthia in St. Petersburg and asking the question whether or not the Attorney General lied to Charlie Crist and Chris Van Hollen at the testimony last month. Hi, Cynthia. You're on MNF.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes. As far as I can tell, and the Attorney General is lying. And the American people need to protest. We need to get this man out of office. He needs to resign. We are seeing too much corruption in our government, and we, the American people, need to stand up. If we don't, then nothing's going to get done. So we need to voice our opinions, we need to get out there and speak with our legislators, and we need to make our voices heard.
All right, Cynthia, thanks a lot. Thank you for calling in, too. And let's go to George, who's in on the road in Seminole. George, you're on live. What would you like to say?
Well, that's a problem with liars. They can't keep their facts straight, and they forget the one lie to the next lie, and Barr is lying through his teeth like everybody else in this whole daggone administration. I'm just waiting for the whole house of cards to come crashing down on them.
Well, I think it is important to hear what Robert Mueller says. I mean, in contrast, what Mueller is saying with what Barr put out in that four-page summary, and whether or not Mueller has any problems with that four-page summary. I hope we get some testimony soon.
I do, too. I would love to have the whole truth come out, but I'm afraid I'm not going to live long enough.
Okay. you may. We may get to the bottom of this yet.
So.
Okay. George, thanks a lot. Thank you.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you for saying that. Bob, who's in Tarpon Springs, writes, the similarities to the Nixon White House are staggering. Anyone remember John Mitchell? John Mitchell was Richard Nixon's attorney general, who also was collecting campaign cash for Nixon's reelection and did act as more of the personal attorney than the attorney general of the U.S. was quite partisan. And back in the Watergate years. Well, thanks to Bill Grace. He's been our phone producer today. Coming up in the next hour, NOLA is away today, and instead we'll hear the Tom Hartman program. I'm sure Tom is going to check in and tell us what his thoughts are about what we've heard from Barr so far. And this is WMNF in Tampa. If you want to comment about today's show, you can call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And we'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for the latest news from NPR, including a recap of what the Attorney General just testified to. And then we'll hear Tom Hartman after the 5 minutes of news headlines. This is WMNF Tampa.